Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
Hope you enjoy
last week, but I saw many of the listeners at the convention, at the Chabad Shluchim event, so felt like we were in touch.
Oh, very nice. I mean, people who actually mentioned the radio show to you.
Who are regular listeners all over. Directly or on the internet.
Unbelievable. And I mentioned to you this, and it's rare that we speak off the air, Mr. Honlein. I'd like to emphasize that whenever I get an opportunity. It is rare that you and I speak off the air purposely. You know that, correct? It is rare.
It's very rare.
However.
It's definitely purposely.
However, I did inform you this week, as I inform my listeners, that the King Solomon Restaurant in Prague is listening to us every single day. How do you like that?
That's correct. But I think people are finally convinced that this is unrehearsed. You will never share with me what you want to ask before we go on the air.
That's correct. And that is one of the reasons why I avoid speaking to Malcolm during the week. But this week, it was almost impossible. I was just taken by so many of the issues of the day. Malcolm, speaking of issues of the day, President Obama was in New York this week and attended a fundraiser hosted by Jack Rosen, and really emphasized the amazing relationship between Israel and the United States. I want to tell you something. Before your, I don't want to say campaign that you've been on, but you have been stressing to us in the last few months how we have to keep in mind, on in terms of the area of intelligence and other areas, military, etc., that the U.S.-Israel relationship is very strong. So I took his words a lot differently because of what you've told us over the last few months. But I did think it was a bit of an exaggeration when he painted a picture as if his administration is the most friendly ever to Israel. What did you think of the president's comments this week at that fundraiser?
Well, it's a fundraiser and it's a political event, and it was for him, so he's free to say what he wants. What I pointed out is that people not look at things in black and white terms, and most of all, not to denigrate the importance of the relationship. It's not because of the politics of it. For me, it's the substance of the importance that Israel has achieved at a time when so many, including people in this administration, have talked about Israel's isolation and how the United States alone. It is not true. Israel is not more isolated than it's ever been in many respects. The changes in the Middle East obviously bring new challenges and redefinitions of relationships, and we don't know where it will end. I'm sure we'll discuss it, but the fact is that the U.S. has come to realize, and an administration that started off definitely on the wrong foot and made many mistakes, as Congressman Nadler, in a very interesting interview yesterday, made some references. A Democratic congressman, very supporter of the president, in the end came around to say that in the interview acknowledged the support, but in the beginning does say how the mistakes and how many errors this administration made in the public posturing of the relationship. And that undermines it, and people exploit that. And it was a point I tried to make to the president in our first meeting that was reported. And so the point is that there is a significance to at least projecting why to the American people and to our own community why Israel is important. We don't have to be defensive about defending Israel and to saying why this is bad, to undermine this relationship, because it is critical to the U.S. as much as it is critical to Israel.
But how different is it 3 years later? In other words, you'd say there have been some nice adjustments, or you'd say it's vastly different?
Well, I think that the military, and as I said many times, Admiral Mullen deserves a lot of credit, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who, together with Gabi Ashkenazi, head of the chief of staff of the IDF, established a very special relationship. There was a relationship before, but during certain periods, I think Secretary Cohen brought things down, whether by design or just part of a process, is for the historians to decide. But I think it certainly has been rebuilt, and we're going to see a very high-profile joint exercise coming up in the early spring. So these are, and it follows on the ones that I have described consistently.
Right.
But it's important, the message that it gives to certain neighbors of Israel, right, in, including Iran.
Right. But the and I don't want to harp on this, but you know what bothers, what concerns everybody, what concerns many people who look, you know, with a skeptical eye to this week's statements. What concerns them is year five. You know, now they're not as concerned. What they are concerned about is if the president is reelected, obviously in campaign mode, you speak differently usually than in the beginning of a new administration or the beginning of a second term mode. And I know that it's hard for you to speak to this point because you're not supposed to convince people one way or the other who to vote for, et cetera. But is the year five concern or year one of a second term, you know, is that something to worry about?
Every time that we have a president up for reelection, people are concerned about what will happen. We've seen presidents who are more friendly become less and some who were less become more. I think events also play a key role, but that's one of the assessments people have to make when they vote is how do they anticipate not how much they love us up until November, but how do they love us after November, after the election?
Right.
What will the behavior pattern be? What are the trends? What do they see in any candidate? Then make an assessment based on it. Also remembering the importance of a congressional election, and that traditionally support has come from Congress. You saw the actions this week, whether on sanctioning the Iran Central Bank, mm-hmm. other actions in support of Israel, that Congress is also important. It's been eclipsed by the presidential election, and I think then in a month or so, once the Republican primaries get out of the way, you'll see that the focus will shift to the congressional races, which will be very tough, and with the redistricting taking place, it will be very sensitive in many places.
We'll go to Egypt and Iran in a moment, but while we're speaking of the administration, you were part of, I guess, what could be considered in some way a historic meeting with the Vice President of the United States on the issue of Jonathan Pollard. If there were other items in the agenda you could share with us, we'd love to know about that. What could you tell us about that encounter?
Well, based on the understanding that we had with him that we would not discuss the substance of the meeting, I can say that it came about, as you remember, when I met the vice president at his home. He had an event there, and I raised the issue of his comments about Pollard at a meeting with some rabbis in Florida, which were widely reported, some say misreported.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him that this can't stand as it is, et cetera, and he agreed to a meeting and then did follow up, and he convened the meeting. It was his invitation. It was a very small meeting, just a half a dozen people.
Right.
And we had more than an hour discussion, and it was almost exclusively about the Pollard case. We made our case, I think, very effectively. We had people coming from different perspectives on it, but all agreed that it was time to let him go. The vice president spoke, was clearly well prepared, made clear that he's not the president. He's not the one who will make the decision. Explained his position. We talked about other aspects of it, and now we'll see what will happen.
Right, but I'd have to assume that he reiterated his point of view that if he were president, or that's the way it sounded, that he would not be in favor of releasing Pollard.
He explained his comments in that regard. Yes. But he did deny saying, that over his dead body or some of the other things that were attributed to him. But his position on it was clear, and he explained why. We explained why we thought, regardless of the argument of substance, which is, a point I've made here on the show for many years, that we've got to argue this on humanitarian grounds. Enough is enough. It's time to let him go. He's expressed remorse. His physical condition, all the reasons that would mandate letting him go. And that's the case we made very effective.
The skeptical or maybe the hopeful tumblers in our community are saying it would be quite a move for the president before November to actually release Pollard.
Well, I think, we have to see what the president does. I don't know how many pardons he's going to give or acts of clemency. He did do some last year, and we'll do some now. I don't anticipate anything this year. I don't want to mislead people.
Right.
I don't think anything's going to happen now. Perhaps if there's some issue in the Middle East or something else, or there's some criteria, and I think that they will have to assess what his health is, what the conditions are, all those things. And you have to get the backing of the agencies, which traditionally have been opposed to it.
Right. I was just wondering if you had a policy of not reacting to Tumblr opinions, that's all.
I do.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. You know, Malcolm, that really the landscape of the weekly update has changed in the last 6 to 12 months because I would say up to about a year ago, I was almost able to grasp most of the issues. Once all the riots, demonstrations, and overturns of government started in practically every government in the Middle East, it's been impossible for me to follow or understand all the implications. So you're going to have to give yet another update in terms of this type of education. In Egypt, I know that elections took place this week, and they were historic and obviously got a lot of media attention just because of the fact that people were able to line up and go vote, but this is or is not a national election?
This is a national election, but it's only the first third. There are going to be two more elections stretching into next year, and each time one-third of the parliament will be elected. These actually covered some of the big cities. Now we're going to move into more rural areas where the Muslim Brotherhood is likely to do even better than what they've done till now.
What have they done till now? Like, do we have results?
The results would generally be, I think, that the Muslim Brotherhood got between 40% and 50% by most estimates. Could be, you know, around 40, I would say, would be a safe bet. Even 38, 39. The surprise here is that the Salafists, who mistakenly in most media are portrayed as being, you know, the extreme Islamists, they are just more extreme on the spectrum than the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood essentially are Salafists too. Mm-hmm. Salafists being the righteous companions of Muhammad, and they go for the more restrict interpretation of Islam, but also very extreme in their beliefs. They, it is estimated, could get up to 20 or even 25% of the vote, which means if Muslim Brotherhood, let's say, got 40 and they got 20, they would be up to 60.
Right.
Which is way beyond what people had anticipated, and the result could be that it might force push the Muslim Brotherhood to become more extreme in their views in order not to have the competition. They announced today that they are going to link up with more liberal parties, not with the Salafists, but I don't think it matters who they link up with. It might even be a tactic to link up with them and by that have the Salafists, who will vote a certain way anyway in the parliament, and that they would then to try to co-opt the more secular liberal parties. The Muslim Brotherhood has had a close working relationship with the military for their own reasons. It may be that they will resent the Salafists or feel threatened by the Salafists, but they benefit because it makes them, quote, look more moderate, unquote, on the moderate.
So that's, you know.
And they will make that case. And so those who want to paint the Muslim Brotherhood as more moderate will have a chance. Now you're talking about a new constitution being formed. You're talking about Christians feeling very endangered. Certainly these understandings with Israel we saw in Tunisia and in Libya and Morocco in the elections that were held. All in each of the cases, these extremist groups have emerged victorious in Morocco. It is considered a more moderate Muslim Brotherhood. The king obviously still retains much of the power, but still, and he embraced the leader of the Jewish community, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood there. But we don't know whether that is not just a front as they establish themselves, because they know the Moroccan people generally are not looking for an extreme form of Islam.
How intimidated does the 30% feel, the secular liberal, as you describe them?
Well, I think that they feel very threatened, and the problem is, as I said, they're going to move into the second election, a third election, in areas where the Muslim Brotherhood, again, are best organized. The secular parties are not organized. They don't have the infrastructure in any of the countries. So elections in all these countries, which everybody praises now, and we want to see real democracy,
right,
and hope that they will, and if they win legitimate elections, they win them. But the thing is that you'll see the accounts about how they worked at the polling booths, how they were, you know, allowed to do things that violated the rules in order to get closer. In Libya, just one thing, we also have the emergence of the extreme Islamists and al-Qaeda types, and they're talking about making Sharia law. They're talking about the sixth caliphate in Tunisia. In Tunisia, in Libya, they're talking about making Sharia law the primary source of legislation. In Yemen, the Islamist movements played a central role in this revolution, more open against the president. And you will see that if the elections are held there, they too will succeed. And then you have in Egypt, Tunisia, the Ennahda party is again painted as more moderate, when in fact we see already they're talking about a constitution that will ban ties with Israel, will put, and frankly for us also jeopardize the Jewish community that is still in Tunisia and in Djerba. So this more moderate country, Tunisia, you see where the Muslim Brotherhood is coming out.
You hear from the Jewish community of Tunisia?
Yes.
And how large is it?
It's not that large. It's a very ancient community. In Djerba, there are more than 1,000 Jews, maybe even 2,000, which I think is the overall population. In Tunis, you have mostly an older population. You have a Jewish old age home. You have other facilities there. I visited the synagogue, and we ended up dancing in the street there. But that was in the good old days. What will happen here, we don't know. And also, we have to think about how this portends for the elections that may take place in Syria. With the help of Turkey, you could easily have a Muslim Brotherhood emerged there as a critical party, just as Hezbollah did in Lebanon and now has taken over responsibility and power, wielding the power in the country.
And when you say a third of the election has already taken place in Egypt, that means geographically they do it by region?
It's not completely by region, but essentially, yes, it's geographic.
So it's by precinct. They just haven't gotten
there. Exactly. That's what it is.
So,
it is by precinct.
And based on the way you're based on your tone, it sounds like the upcoming precincts are even more radical than what we've seen already.
It's not more radical, they're more rural. And there, the Egyptian Brotherhood has even better organization because it's, you know, all the mosques become political bases for these guys. And I know the reaction of the Copts in the Christians of Egypt, that they are deeply concerned about this. There's concern about what this will mean for the relationship with Israel, for the peace treaty with Israel. There are some of them who have said that they would abrogate it, but that is not expected because Egypt's economy and economic recovery depends on tourism. You know, there's almost zero tourism, which used to yield up to $1 billion or more a month. Second is this income from the Suez Canal. Third is trade and the money that they get from the United States, which is contingent on the implementation of the Camp David Accord. So on all those grounds, all right, Israel is very critical to them.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean that you won't see a demand to rewrite it, to restrict it, to you know, and not to implement and make a cold peace even colder.
Right. So there is some, for those who are, you know, who worry about Israel's political position, there is some political clout still. There is some influence.
Absolutely.
And again, the importance of the United States-Israel relationship. We see it again.
You know what? Just one that's interesting statistic that I read last week was that since Mubarak fell, there have been 1 million new babies in Egypt. You know, so it's a country of 87 million people. The problems are so deep. It's not the people who are just getting into the streets, and a small percentage of the people of Egypt have participated in these events. And, you know, they talk about million-man marches. They don't end up being
right.
That. But Egypt is being perceived increasingly as a country that's unsafe. Its foreign reserves are down to $22 billion, which is about covers about 4 months of their imports. The pipeline keeps getting blown up, which means that they're losing the income from it. In every respect, you know, this is a very dangerous situation for the most powerful country in the Middle East.
So, man of the year in Egypt is the media. Without the media, they would never have been able to have such a strong opposition. If in fact what you're saying is accurate, that the numbers don't bear out the type of protests that, you know, the media is portraying.
Well, the media. Portrayed. There were protests, but I think
I understand that
they're not in the context. You know, that when they called for that million-man march against the Israeli embassy, 800 people showed up. The storming of the embassy was largely by people who were paid to do it. You know, the media is not going behind the scenes, and frankly, I'm not sure that they can,
right.
Certainly the external media. But, I mean, they have reported, and I think the coverage of what's happening is clear. But when you see with a third of the precincts this clear mandate for the Islamists emerging, it has got to be of concern to the United States, the U.S. military, to Saudi Arabia, to other countries, because Egypt obviously could set the tone. And we already see this domino effect across North Africa, and, you know, Jordan, we hear the problems that the king is having and the unrest there and the threats there. Morocco, which is a stable country, and, you know, the king is still very popular, so it's not exactly comparable to the other circumstances. Libya has no government, but the Al-Qaeda and others are clearly becoming more forceful. We hear more calls for Sharia law and for the imposition of Islamist positions. I think that...
I'm laughing because despite all that, you know that as especially now, it's December, as the media gets ready to review 2011, all they'll talk about is the spread of democracy in the Middle East with all the elections, etc.
Yeah, and as you know for many times, and I spoke about this last weekend, that people not be, you know, not be fooled into believing that this is about democracy.
Right.
It's about a lot of other things, including corruption and, you know, many, many issues, primarily food and food insecurity and jobs. And it has to do with corruption, and people do want democracy. People do. The turnout in Egypt was remarkable.
Right. Malcolm, did Great Britain have any choice but to pull its diplomats out of Tehran?
Well, they could have left some people, but I think it's an important message and reflects the seriousness of what this attack on the British embassy really represents. And I think it did not get fully... appreciated here. I mean, this is a repetition of what happened in 79. It could not have happened without government compliance, government involvement. The Bashigis are the extreme of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, which is extreme in and of itself. They, the whole, you know, it took hours and hours for them to respond to it. I think the British, if you remember an incident a couple of years ago with British sailors, 15, I think, that were caught supposedly in international waters. The Iranians said it was in their waters, and they humiliated them. Remember, they made a march, and they made them, and they kept exposing them, and finally released them, but suffered no consequence. So when people ask, why is it important, why we ask and demand that there be some consequence, whether it's the Palestinians for the things they do or from others, because if not, they get the message that you can get away with everything and just move on. That's why they know that the others and the Europeans are not going to do anything, and they can humiliate and even threaten in this way and violate what is supposedly sacred, which is the embassies of another country. Could have stopped it, didn't. And with all of this, the IRGC gains, you know, they just had tenders for construction and other things, $500 million, $500 million. It all went to the Iran Revolutionary Guard companies, who are extending their influence and becoming more powerful in this situation. And even with the blasts that you see, you know, the explosions that took place, which are great significance, you see what the reaction is. And what one would believe that it would have undermined the confidence in the Iran Revolutionary Guard, the military, the capacity to prevent these, quote, work accidents, which may well have damaged the conversion plant near Natanz. And the...
What, do you mean this week's explosion?
Mm-hmm.
May have damaged, say it again?
The nuclear conversion plant near Natanz.
Well, why don't we know if it in fact did or didn't?
Because there's some dispute. I have gotten seen reports that they have satellite photos which show damage. I don't know that they can drill down deep enough to see exactly. There's a steel plant right next to it.
And this was a planted explosive. And it wasn't a bomb. It wasn't a bomb.
There was an explosion. You know, the satellite doesn't take pictures all the time of every facility.
No, but meaning it wasn't a bomb from the sky.
It was not a bomb from the sky. It was something that happened in the ground. As you remember, there was one 2 weeks ago on a missile base which took out the father of their missile development program, supposedly in the midst of a drill of an attack for missiles to be attacked to use in an attack on Israel. This one is at it was near the Natanz uranium conversion. They say there was a military drill. They denied a blast. Then they admitted, well, there was a blast, but it was an accident. Then they said munitions exploded. Clearly, the deputy mayor said there was an explosion. Other people were calling the fire department, so they had to acknowledge at least that it took place. They kept trying to cover. There are still people who in the administration in Iran who are trying to cover it and deny what took place. But it's clearly another one of a series of work accidents, and there will be retaliation at some point from the Iranians. They're not just going to you know, continue to allow this to go, but they can't control the media. One of the things they did this week
But just 1 second on this. How far is that uranium enrichment plant from what we know as the, you know, classic nuclear plant that is building this nuclear weaponry?
That's in Combs. That's not,
which
that's
is how not, far from each other?
That, look, none of these are very far. One is, I think, west and one is south of Tehran. They're not next to each other. The Combs development is a huge new development. Natanz was a known facility. Where,
so there are multiple targets. You can't when someone wants to take out someone's nuclear capability.
Yes, that's exactly right.
When you want to take out nuclear capability, you have to plan for multiple attacks. I mean, if you want to get everything, I'm saying.
And that's exactly why when people ask me, you know, why doesn't Israel just attack? Why it's not like Iraq and OC Iraq, which was one facility.
Right.
They're spread out. There are places we probably don't know. It is far more complicated, far more complicated. And the new place in Combs is inside a mountain. It may not be penetrable, even to bunker busters. As you know, I think it happened during the time we were not on the air, but the United States got 14 bunker busters that are six times the size of the regular one. There are only 14 in the world. And in addition, they announced the sale to the UAE, United Arab Emirates, in the Gulf, of bunker busters, a large number, and of guided munitions. I don't know what they would need them for, except for perhaps protecting themselves from an Iranian attack or to participate. But this one of the deadlines that is seen when they talk about the window closing is once Qom is completely operative. That, I think, people see as one of the critical determinants that the window for response is closing.
Let me do a couple of more headlines and just bring up a couple of more things before we go into further depth on this. Was there, in fact, an infiltration by the American CIA into Hezbollah in Lebanon?
Yes.
And how did the Hezbollah administration react to this?
Look, it's not the first time. They accuse Israel and the United States of infiltrating all the time. They have arrested and executed many people for allegedly being ties, and supposedly a Mossad network was uncovered recently in Lebanon. So they reacted in the way they reacted before. They took great credit for it, that they were able to find them and expose them.
So the fact that they were discovered, I mean, obviously it's embarrassing, but is it a big deal in the U.S. or not?
Yes.
It is a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal when you have an intelligence network, and that led in part to the same thing happening in Iran, where U.S. intelligence agencies supposedly were arrested as a result of or linked to by people I've asked to the discovery of the network in Lebanon, led to the uncovering of the spies in Iran itself.
Does technology today just make it so much tougher to stay under the radar?
That's right.
Simple as that.
And the equipment was sold to Hezbollah. By the way, you know, we don't talk about it, but there's still so much arms movement from Syria to Hezbollah, high-tech equipment that the Iranians supply them with, as they supplied Syria with stuff to keep track of the demonstrators and to break the computer communication, the internet communications. This technology and the Russians, by the way, selling very high-tech, very sophisticated missiles just delivered this week to Syria. It's almost mind-boggling. If you tell it to people, they all think you're nuts. That, you know, how could they be selling this stuff in the middle of all this? They're saying, well, it's to set off, it's to counter an attack by sea. And the Russians, in fact, announced that they're going to put warships there at the beginning of the year. I mean, this is unbelievable. But the Russians have really staked a position, which I think they will come to regret later on.
How does Assad withstand all this pressure he's getting from the Arab League? And does he have a friend left?
Yes, they have a friend in Iran and a friend in Iraq. Iraq was the only country that voted against the sanctions. It's interesting that Lebanon only abstained. The Hezbollah is beginning to distance itself a little bit from them. Even though they're dependent upon them for
To what benefit? Why would it be necessary for them to do that?
To do what?
To distance himself from Syria.
Because of the isolation, because of the resentment in Lebanon against the murders of over 4,000 people. And so the Sunni population, because Sunnis are largely the ones being killed resent any kind of expressions of support and failure to condemn. Even Hamas had to condemn them, Assad and the regime, and that led to a lessening of support from Iran for Hamas and retaliation for it. So it's the same thing. Turkey also, if you remember, supported Assad and then made demands of him and wanted him to stop her killing the Sunnis because of the domestic population demanded it of them, and then they wanted to get the Muslim Brotherhood into the cabinet in a significant number of seats, and he refused, and that sort of was the coup d'etat to their relationship. And now Turkey is threatening to create a flyover zone. They're threatening to take military action and to create zones on the border where army defectors and others could come.
It's just funny to see Hezbollah and Hamas calling somebody else the bad guys, you know what I mean? The money that Israel released to the PA, tax money, customs money, etc., why hold it for all these years if in a relatively unprovoked fashion you're handing it over to them anyway?
No, this is only money for 1 month.
Why did I read 4 years?
They did not hold it. They've been paying this money for a long time, but this is money. This is tax income for the PA that Israel collects at ports and other places and turns over each month. So they were holding up this month's payment of taxes, and a lot of international pressure came on Israel and the feeling that, you know, Fayyad would be undermined, even though Fayyad is completely undermined as it is. And he said yesterday that he would not head a unity government, even though an interesting poll showed that more than 50% of Palestinians said they wanted him to. But both Fatah and Hamas have said that they don't want him. The Hamas is absolutely adamant about, you know, eliminating him. And his whole thrust was that he was the guy fighting corruption. The West loves him. Mm. And yet we saw that two ministers just in a week were fired for corruption, one for a profiteer and one for some sort of acts of profanity. And I don't know exactly what they were. And, you know, the many other ministers, Minister of Labor, Minister of Economy, they were all sacked for various acts of corruption. So you don't even have that facade of honesty that Fayyad tried to impose.
All right, I apologize for the headline fashion here, but we're already over time. I just want to get to a couple of things. So the fact that Great Britain has essentially severed its ties with Iran, I would think for the good guys, so to speak, this is a big benefit, right? This is a benefit of this attack on the embassy in Tehran. And will it, in fact, lead to tougher sanctions from Great Britain and other folks in Europe?
UK is talking about new oil embargoes, and they said that they will support the oil embargo. The EU, European Union, takes in about 450,000 barrels a day. Egypt, England is not a primary customer, but they will support increased sanctions. France and Germany sort of have said they would, but they're waffling a little bit. And Britain announced after this that they would even go unilaterally into additional sanctions. Remember, America has no presence there, and the loss of the British presence, I think, for dissidents and others, probably is not seen in such a positive light.
Good point.
They want more Western presence.
All right. The 29th of November, which we emphasized on this show at the beginning of this week, a poll shows 73% of Israeli adults don't even know the historical significance of the date. We could discuss that another time. Is there, in fact, on the 29th of November, a Palestinian Solidarity Day at the United Nations?
This is, to me, one of the most outrageous things of a very outrageous week, and every week seems to get more and more outrageous and more dangerous. But this, what the Secretary General of the UN did in response to the, you know, this is sponsored by the United Nations. They have it every year, and they adopted a resolution known as the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. But Ban Ki-moon issued a statement, and I'll just cite two things because we don't have time.
Sure, but
to say that, one, that the Palestinian Authority is now institutionally ready to assume the responsibilities of statehood, when the UN report itself said they're not ready to do it. That was issued just in the last weeks. And they said no matter the fact that what they did at the UN was a violation of UN resolutions, roadmap, et cetera. The second thing he said in this also was Jerusalem must emerge from negotiations as the capital of two states. But they want to negotiate a peace settlement, he said, on the final status issues, including Jerusalem. Why does he preempting that? But he said that the settlement activity is contrary to international law.
Oh, boy.
But he says that the Gaza fire rockets and the attempts to smuggle weapons are actions that are unacceptable and contrary to Palestinian interests. Hello? International law? Where's the imbalance here? It's just incredible to me.
Unbelievable. The New York terrorist, or the potential terrorist, Jose Pimentel, this is going back a couple of weeks right after the last time we spoke. How deep was his relationship with Al-Qaeda?
You know, the truth is we never know in all of these cases how much of the relationship exists, but or immediately we're always told that this is a lone operative,
right.
And then we find out that they, in fact, were influenced either on the Internet directly, were there, met them, some minister, you know, and the conversions that they go through, even if they're not necessarily born as Muslims, and become radicalized. So there are connections. It's often hard to detect them, and they don't turn, you know, others in. Others have, and the more we learn then about the nature of the network, and then he goes to prison, where he's likely to be indoctrinated even more.
No doubt about it. Malcolm, thank you so much. Have a great Shabbos. We'll speak next week. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call it the Weekly Update, Fridays at JM and the AM.